Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Warren Bird, Director of Research and Intellectual Capital at the Leadership Network, a nonprofit that helps innovative Christian leaders increase their impact. He is the author and or co-author of roughly a bazillion books, including Viral Churches, Helping Church Planters Become Movement Makers, The Other 80%, Turning Your Church's Spectators into Active Participants, The Emotionally Healthy Church, A Strategy for Discipleship That Actually Changes Lives. Next, Pastoral Succession That Works, which we featured on a previous podcast with his co-author William Vanderblomen, and most recently, Teams That Thrive, Five Disciplines of Collaborative Church Leadership, co-written with Ryan Hartwig. That latter book will be the focus of our talk today, though I am sure many of his insights from previous works will seep their way into our discussion. Warren has a PhD from Fordham University, Go Rams, where he developed a specialty in studying megachurches. He also holds a Master's of Divinity from Alliance Theological Seminary and also attended Wheaton College and Wheaton Graduate School. But wait, he's not just some egghead who studies stuff and then professes, like your fuzzy little host here, but rather he is a doer as well, having been an ordained minister for over 20 years and serving most recently on the staff of Princeton Alliance Church. Also, I should note that in addition to all of this wonderful biographical material, Warren is a regular listener to our podcast, which is really cool. We will link to his personal website, the Leadership Network, all of his books, and some related podcasts that you might enjoy over at our website. Please be sure to tell your friends about us as we are quickly approaching 250 episodes in our searchable archives, and there is something for everybody interested in religion in those storage crates down there in our internet basement. Warren, welcome to Research on Religion.
Wow, Tony, thank you for such a quite an elaborate build-up. It makes me look very forward to what your guest is going to say to try to match all those accolades in your setup.
Well, that was only about a tenth of what I could say, because if I had to run down the list of all the books that you've written or co-authored, we would be here for about a half an hour. So really, there's a lot of other stuff. And I'm going to point people to your bio because there is a lot of really neat stuff out there. But really what impresses me is that you've gone from a listener of Research on Religion to a guest. That is very neat.
Well, and as you said, I enjoy your podcast, and I want to echo to everybody listening, there's a lot of good stuff on interviews that he's done, so do take a look.
Well, feel the love out there, man. This is great. But before we get on to your book, Teams That Thrive, Five Disciplines of Collaborative Church Leadership, I want to focus on another thing, and that is something that's come up in the news a little bit, and I want to pick your brain on this. Now, I should note to listeners, we are recording this in mid-May of 2015, and the Pew Research Center has recently released a study that has received significant attention because it claims to have discovered a significant drop in the number of people calling themselves Christian in the United States, and that has been really shaking up a lot of people, and you hear it a lot discussed on the radio and on the news reports. The top line analysis in that report says there's been an 8% decrease in Christians in the United States over the past 7 or so years, which does gel with some of their earlier studies regarding the increase of nuns, N-O-N-E-S, or folks with no religious preference in America. Warren, I know that you have not had time to digest much of that report as it just came out, but I was wondering if you have any thoughts about the U.S. religious landscape today, because I think this might come into play on the overall context of church leadership.
Sure. In brief, I'm thrilled that Pew and others are researching religion. You know, it got dropped out of census stuff, so it's really up to various nonprofits and others to understand this central piece of American life, where the vast majority believe in God and are part of some kind of faith group, and so this is helpful. Now, in particular, Pew, you know, has quite a sensational headline that it says the Christians decline sharply as share of a population and all, and I'm not sure I read their and other people's data as quite the sky as falling, so much as there's a lot of realignment happening. Certainly mainline churches, denominations, absolutely have dropped. Certainly evangelical churches, as they point out, at denominations, are increasing. But more important, an awful lot of people who were, in my view, what could be called cultural Christians, who, meaning, well, I'm not Hindu and I'm not Muslim, so I guess I identify as Christian. In today's culture, where there's so much less pressure to identify with a particular faith group, and the dominant faith group in particular, are choosing to say none, no religious affiliation. Even though a surprising number of the nuns are very strong about their faith in God, they are disaffiliating with institutional religion. And there are other factors that come into play. So, insightful survey. You got to make some summaries, but there's a lot of good news in what they found as well.
Yeah, when I looked at their analysis and you dig deeper than just the top line headline there, you actually find out that evangelicals, as you said, are increasing a little bit. They're in other places, they're holding their own. It's really been the mainline denominations, the old mainlines, the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, etc., that have been seeing declines in that. But that's been going on for 20, 30, 40 years or so.
Yes, and even that is a little difficult to categorize in that Pew group people by denomination, and just before this interview, I hung up the phone with a mainline pastor who, you know, in the survey would have been counted as one of the declining congregations, but he happens to be extremely evangelical in theology. His church has been growing for a number of years, and he skews their curve because you have evangelicals in all denominations, and frankly, you have those of other persuasions within denominations. So, grouping by denominations is a handle that works, but it's got a lot of limitations.
And the growth of non-denominational churches too becomes a difficult thing to deal with in some of these surveys. I know a lot of churches say, "Well, we're not denominationally aligned. We're not really religious. We just love Jesus."
Yeah, one out of five churches in the United States today calls itself non-denominational. That is a huge chunk of the pie.
So how do these overall changes affect church leadership strategies? We're going to dig into your book in a little bit more detail here in a few minutes, but I can imagine that the person you were just talking to on the phone a few minutes ago was thinking about these larger issues and has to think about it in terms of how do we bring people into the pews on a daily basis? How do we manage our church on a week-to-week, month-to-month, year-to-year basis? What are some of your thoughts on the changing religious landscape and church leadership writ large?
Well, this kind of forecasts a question that, Tony, you do such a great job of forecasting what the questions can be so that responders like me do a much better job than we might normally do. But you forecast, you know, why did I write the book? And that really ties into the question you just asked. And that is that so many churches are moving towards a team approach to leadership. And as even part of a bigger piece, so many churches are recognizing the importance of leadership development. And so team ministry is just one more aspect of that. And leadership teams, senior leadership team, which is what the book focuses on, is one piece of that whole.
Let me ask this before digging into the leadership, because this comes up, I see it a lot on Facebook and talked about in the media. Is it a problem that churches seem to be chasing culture too much today rather than sticking to their principal grounds? And this is why they're possibly losing the, especially younger folks, that they try to be a hipster church, but hipsterism passes with the changing winds. And now the church is left with a certain identity that nobody is really interested in anymore. Are churches chasing culture too much?
Well, every church is culturally relevant to something or someone. Even the choice of the language that we speak, or the nuances of, if it's English, is it hipster English, and our music as well. What so often happens is that a church finds a winning combination of how to connect with the surrounding culture, and then the church fixes on that. The method, it becomes married to the message, and because the message doesn't change, at least theologically, the idea that, you know, it's a timeless gospel, but the methods do, and so often churches don't realize that, well, as Lyle Schaller said so well, 8 out of 10 churches are totally ready for 1955 to come around again, in that they haven't changed with the culture. Now, is there danger of becoming so culturally attuned that what comes across more is my cultural identification than my message? Yes, indeed, that's a danger as well.
So I can imagine that leadership teams or church leaders in specific have to really be on the lookout constantly for how they're balancing all of this. They don't want to become 1955 churches waiting for 1955 to roll around again. They don't want to become too culturally relevant. So it seems like you're providing a very valuable resource in that you're raising awareness about, hey, leadership, you have to think about that on a daily and weekly and monthly basis.
Exactly. And in particular, churches that have gone to a team model, it seems like most churches you talk to of every size are in some way doing team more than they did in the past. Now the question is, well, how do we know if our team is any good? And how do we help our team get better at what we're doing?
So let's dig into that. And you co-authored this book with Ryan Hartwig called Teams That Thrive, Five Disciplines of Collaborative Church Leadership. And it's an interesting book because it opens up that black box of church management. And a lot of us don't necessarily think about that. The typical churchgoer shows up on Sunday, hears a message, but really has little grasp about what is going on behind the scenes on Monday and Tuesday and Thursday evening and Friday morning, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, one of your other books, we mentioned early in the introduction, says that 80% of any given congregation just tends to be there on Sunday, and well, that's about it. They maybe sing a few hymns and maybe help put away some chairs, but that is about it. So this is a book about church leadership, and I can imagine it's important for church leaders, but is it also relevant for folks that sit in the pews on a daily basis?
Well, one of the things we observe is, as goes the senior leadership team, so go, by ripple effect, almost everybody else in the church. So, for example, if those who speak on Sunday morning are from time to time referencing, either verbally or it comes up in the bulletin or other things, that, you know, hey, we do things as a team, we're developing, we're growing, we're taking risks together, we're learning how to do conflict in a healthy way. Well, that models for every other team, ministry group, committee, and everything else in the church as well. So our focus in the book is on that senior team, whatever it's called. It goes by a lot of different names. But realizing that there'll be many other players looking over the shoulder and saying, well, that would impact our worship ministry team or what youth ministry steering team or whatever.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about this issue. You've used the word teams quite a bit here. And the inspiration from your for your book must have come about by the fact that you're seeing the word team be used a lot more. Is this a growing trend in Christian churches? Because again, you know, as a typical pastor say, well, you know, the pastor's in charge, maybe as an assistant pastor, and that's how the church is run. Has team leadership been increasing over the past decades?
Absolutely. First, let me distinguish between team and committee, why the word team, I think, is more popular. Committee implies this is a group that's going to make a recommendation for somebody else to decide. Team implies a greater sense of empowerment that we're going to decide and act upon the decision. And actually, we open the book with a bunch of myths of what we've discovered about churches. And one of the myths is that people think team means a bunch of us advise the senior pastor, who then makes the decision and does the implementation, and we've done our job just advising. And our sense and interpretation is that that is a poorly functioning team, and one that loses huge potential for the different talents, skills, and abilities of those represented around the table. And those represented around the table increasingly are a diverse group, whereas 20 years ago, maybe when you had the team, that would be limited. Oh, that's just the ordained people at the top of the organizational chart. Today, and our research that we'll discuss in a bit bears this out, the team is a much more diverse collection of people from different levels, different talents, ordained or not, different roles, and functioning together in a way to do things that any individual alone could not do nearly as well.
That helps us define a little bit of the term church teams. And you mentioned they go by a number of different names. They can be called elders or sometimes committees. And you made a good case of why you don't necessarily use the word committee. It has a more hierarchical sense to it. But yeah, sometimes they're called those kind of things. Is there any typical senior team modeled, or do these things look very different?
They look different because now I'm speaking within Protestantism, and that was the scope of our survey, and that the Catholic Church has a more preset and different way of functioning, though we've had some feedback already from Catholic readers saying, you know, hey, this was really helpful for us too. But among Protestant churches, there is a wide variety of polity, traditions, and on, we tried to speak to whoever that top group is, and we tried to use just the language that's most commonly used, executive team, for example, and knowing that everybody would have to apply it and say, oh, well, we call ours, you know, the pastor's council, but I get what you mean, and so I'm going to be able to translate this book into our context.
Now, in terms of teams, you've studied mega churches, and mega churches are defined as having roughly 2,000 plus members or so.
Actually, but 2,000 plus attenders.
Attenders, okay, which is different than members, right?
Yeah.
Yes, that's very important to remember. So more than 2,000 attenders, but a lot of churches here in the United States, well, you know, they're not that big. They're only maybe 70, 80, 100 attenders on any given Sunday. Are these churches, these smaller churches, ones that have teams, or is the team phenomena really located in the mega church sector of Christianity?
Teams are across all church sizes. We interviewed, you know, a church of 100 that had a 3-person team. Only one was paid. 2 were bivocational, but this church was committed to doing leadership as team, and it was not the exception. There are an awful lot of churches in the church that I attend is on a typical Sunday just shy of 200 people, and the pastor has made a commitment. In fact, when we called him, we called him to be the lead pastor rather than the senior pastor, even though there's only one pastor on day, because the idea is you lead the team that you will continue to develop. And the team is largely it's entirely of volunteers outside of himself. But still, that's team. Now, the larger you get in attendance, the more it is required that just the sheer organizational complexity requires that you have a structured team, and the more likely that team is made up of paid people. But a book was written to the team, whether volunteer, a mix of volunteer and paid staff, or all paid staff. And we tried to use examples from all that, too.
Yeah, and it does cover a wide range of different churches. In fact, as I read the book, you mentioned Catholics earlier. You were basically focused on Protestantism, but I read this as, you know, Catholics could benefit from this. Jewish congregations could benefit from this as well. This is an issue about, you know, an organization that has a lot of volunteers who, you know, come and go into the church, and this is how you can make use of a lot of these folks. So it's really interesting how you do that. I will also admit that when I started reading the book, it came across, especially from the title, as a little bit kind of like a self-help book. Right? If I pick this up, it says, well, here's the five leadership disciplines, blah, blah, blah. And as I got into this, though, and very quickly, you point this out, this is more than one of those just pedantic, I got some really great ideas, I'm going to throw them out there. There's some really good social science studying in this book. You have a PhD in sociology of religion, so you're familiar with rigorous methodological studies, and that serves as the basis of your book. So in terms of this book, what did you do to study this issue of team management?
Well, I did it as a team, so let me give a shout out to the lead author, Ryan Hartwick, who likewise is a PhD, University of Colorado. He teaches now at Azusa Pacific University and is one of the deans there as well. He's a communications professor. And he and I, there was a very rigorous numbers crunching season where we tried to pull all this together. The research in particular, well, let me say it this way. We had one of our first interviews, the guy said, oh, I'm going to ask you a really tough question. You know, I just Googled church leadership team, you know, and came up with hundreds of books on the topic. You know, tell me how yours is different. And I said, actually, ours is the only book, to our knowledge, that blends the following elements. Rigorous research from the business world, where we try to pull the best of, because the business world has had a focus on teams in recent years, plus a unique study of church leadership teams, which we fielded ourselves and involved also a well-known the team diagnostic survey by an acclaimed Harvard researcher, and one where we try to give examples from multiple churches. So while there are numerous books out there, great books, that say, you know, here's what I've learned about doing teams at the church I serve, and those are wonderful, we've tried to be broader and say, all right, what's across the board and what does the research say? And then we illustrated it. We actually went out, we picked the top 10% of those that did a survey, and we visited a bunch of them. Ryan Hartwick, lead author, got some grant money. I had some funds to work with, and we sat in on senior leadership teams and did further interviews that way.
Yeah, it's multi-method based, and that is really interesting. So you started out by sending out some questionnaires, and you got some back. What was basically the sample size on this, and what was your sample population? Who were you targeting?
1,026 senior leadership team members at 253 different churches.
Okay. So that sounds about 4 to 5 people per church?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And was there any particular type of church you were targeting? Were you looking at just mega churches? Were you trying to run the gamut from the small church to the big church? And how'd you end up trying to look for these folks?
I oversee a newsletter at Leadership Network that goes to over 50,000 church leaders, leadnet.org/advance, and we publicized it there. Each of us blogged it. We networked with those who had networks and basically said, hey, we got a deal where this team diagnostic survey is going to, for the first time, be open to churches and be free. So if you would like to get an assessment of your church, just follow this link. So it got tweeted all over, and there were just a few parameters. You needed to be a Protestant church and in the United States, but beyond that, and Canada, beyond that, you could take the survey. And then we got 253 during the two-month season, I think it was, that we had the survey open, and started crunching from there. Actually, then we did a follow-up survey and said, okay, you've taken the team diagnostic survey from Harvard. Would you also take the unique one that we designed just for churches? And then we combined the two.
So tell me about the response rate to this. You mentioned you sent this out. It was tweeted all around the place. And so it has elements of a snowball sample to some respect. Did you get a pretty representative sample of churches in the United States, or was it skewed in one direction, that the big churches tended to respond more, perhaps the small churches?
We did get more larger churches, and that's because that's who Leadership Network predominantly works with. But and when we looked at the top 10%, we made sure to say, okay, before we pick this slice, you know, let's peek at the geography. You know, do they happen to represent different segments of the United States? Do we have some denominational, some non-denominational? Is there a good range of sizes and all? And looking at that and seeing the answer is yes, we thought, okay, this gives us enough to pull from for our kind of exemplar group. So it's a convenient sample, but we know enough of church world to feel like there is at least some representativeness in it.
And that's true. Those kind of samples are useful as well, because you can look within the dynamic of the sample set to see what is going on. Even though, you know, some people might question, well, can you extrapolate this to other churches, you know, Catholic churches or churches that didn't respond? You know, maybe there's some question on that, but there's still a lot that you can learn internally from these kind of surveys. The next question I have is the questionnaire that you used. You mentioned a couple times here this Team Diagnostic Study, or TDS. What is that called again?
The Team Diagnostic Survey, which the Harvard researchers and corporate consultants had developed and used in their private consulting practice, and that we wrote them and said, you know, hey, would you consider using Teams? And I don't have the number of questions. I probably should have, knowing that I'm talking with another social scientist. But it was a rather rigorous survey, and then we had our own, which had 50-some-odd questions. And so we felt like we got a good profile of the churches, at least as they self-assess themselves. And that was almost humorous in that, you know, some of the open-ended, you know, what's the purpose of your team? And then we would, your senior leadership team, that is, and then we would look at people in the same church to say, my goodness, are they all on the same team? And even more humorous was we asked, how many people regularly serve on your senior leadership team? And more than half of the churches disagreed on the amount of people on there. And you'd say, well, that's because, you know, we're gearing up for Christmas, Easter, whatever, and we brought in, you know, an extra person to help us plan for that event. No, it wasn't just a difference of one member. It was like, you know, one person saying, well, we have 9 members on it, another saying we have 4. So we learned a lot by enjoying how people responded.
Yeah, and that is interesting information of itself that tells you a lot about the team. Does the team actually know who the team is?
Right. And to the positive, that speaks to the fluidity of teams, that there's people that come on and come off, and the multiplicity of teams. Well, you know, there's that kind of blurs. Well, there's the pastor's executive team, but then there's also the, you know, the pastor's direct reports, which, you know, are some of the same but not all the same. And then there's the hallway conversation piece. And actually, we found research-wise, because we asked, you know, to what extent is your meeting, you know, a sit-down type thing, and to what extent does it involve hallway-type conversations, we actually found that the more teams that include an element of hallway spontaneous conversations, the healthier and more effective they seem.
That's interesting. And we'll return back to that later. But I can imagine how that works, especially within a church environment, right? Within a business where you have to be there from 9 to 5, the meetings that you meet at 1 p.m. in the conference room are probably much more typical. But, you know, with a church, people have different vocations outside of the church environment, and so they got to meet at different times. And so I can imagine there's a lot of the informal, quote-unquote, hallway conversations that go on, but probably over coffee or, you know, meeting at somebody's house for a Bible study or different things like that.
Exactly. And remember that the larger the church, the more likely it is to be multi-site, which means one church in two or more locations. And those two or more locations, on average, are quite a distance from each other. And so now we have the issue of, okay, how do we get all of us together? And so those random times, well, hey, we're coming over to be involved in the such and such ministry that's being hosted on your campus. So while we're at it, I want to check in with you on a couple of things of planning nature and the like.
So you did a survey that was based upon the team diagnostic survey, and you called this the team communication questionnaire. Is that correct?
Correct. It was kind of the Harvard one was kind of generic in that it could fit any context. And then we wanted to drill down specifically about churches. And frankly, we had a number of theories we wanted to test out about church leadership teams in particular.
Well, I am interested in theories all the time, and those help to generate questions. So give us a little flavor of some of the things you asked. You don't have to go through the whole survey, but if I was taking one of these surveys at a church in Nebraska somewhere, what are some of the things I might be seeing?
In the past month or so, how often has a significant team decision been made not by the senior pastor in the following areas? Or another question, there are common purposes of a church senior leadership team. Rank in order which best describes the purpose of your senior leadership team. Just an aside here, it becomes apparent very quickly if you think about it that a lot of people's knee-jerk is to say, well, the purpose of our senior leadership team is the purpose of the church. Of course, we're aligned, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. If your purpose is identical to that of the whole church, then is anybody else necessary? You're doing everything. No. Your purpose as a team is a particular niche in helping reach the overall purpose. Or vision statement, mission statement of the church.
Okay. So you're investigating a number of different dimensions here. I heard a question on how often do you meet and do people outside of the group actually contribute to decision making, and then also defining purpose. Any other dimensions that you're looking at too?
Well, to what extent is your church facing organizational challenges right now? How, on average, how many different meetings a week does your team meet? And then we break it into formal and informal. Describe the agenda for your regular senior leadership team meeting. Is it? And then these are all multiple choice so that we could crunch numbers more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also ask about the pastor's style. And most important, rating your team's, well, not most important, rating the self-rating of your team's effectiveness. Then we also had our own grid for what we thought was effectiveness, such as alignment of purpose. And it gave us a lot of things to have fun with. In fact, there's a footnote in the book that said, hey, if you're a scholar and want to play further with the data, write us. You know, we'd love to have somebody else take a swipe and in a good way. and play with it and see what else can be learned. It's a rich database.
Oh, well, wonderful. So all you scholars out there interested in that stuff, and I'm fascinated by church organization at the nuts and bolts level, so you might get an email from me asking me to play around with the data stuff for a little bit. So you did this survey. You sent it out to a number of churches. Churches responded. They gave some interesting results. You started sorting through this. One of the other things that you did was that you went and made actual church visits. So it's not just a quantitative questionnaire survey methodology, but you're actually going out and doing some qualitative soaking and poking at some of these places. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was a lot of fun. we wrote churches and said, hey, you know, you did the survey, thanks. Can one of us, or in some cases both of us, come and visit your church and sit in for a day, whatever day you have your formal senior leadership team meeting. And hey, if we can be of help to you, you know, debriefing or just offering some thoughts afterwards, we'd love to. And 100% of those who said, you know, please come, we just had delightful conversations afterwards, so we felt like we were able to give back to them. And frankly, I've sat in an awful lot of senior leadership team meetings in different contexts over the years, and going to kind of the vanguard or top-performing group, I really sensed a difference. It's like they were functioning on all cylinders. There was an esprit de corps. There was a lot of laughter. Typically, there was a delightful diversity of gifts and perspectives, and of people on it. And it was a very fulfilling experiment. And then, of course, anybody featured in the book, if they are named by name, we got their permission in advance. And if they're anonymous, that means they didn't give their opinion permission.
Mm-hmm. And you said that you sat in a lot of successful ones. Were you invited to see some of the more unsuccessful ones? Were there some churches that said, you know what, we're really dysfunctional, we need some help here, could you come and take a look at us?
Actually, we didn't. We, you know, did the survey, got the result, picked the top 10%, and then, you know, tried to get a nice spread of churches within that top 10%, geographically, size-wise, et cetera, and, you know, who were, and of those, you know, which were willing to have us come visit.
Geographically, huh? Did you do any churches in Hawaii?
No, but I really felt called to do that.
Who doesn't?
No, didn't do that, but covered everywhere from where I'm based, just outside of New York City, to California, Texas, Florida, Illinois, and places in between.
Okay. So let's go ahead and dig into the results now. And we've already covered some of the questions I've been interested in, and such as, you know, what does a typical team look like? And as you note, there really are no typical teams. They can vary quite a bit, and they can vary by the size of the church and by the denomination as well. Actually, that's a question I have. Did you see any strong denominational tendencies? You know, some churches are much more Episcopal, hierarchically organized. Others are much more congregational, grassroots type of congregations. Did you see any difference in terms of team leadership across those denominations?
No. So much more had to do with the personality of the leader and the life stage of the church. In other words, a church that's 8 years old versus a church that's 80 years old. And to some degree, whether this was a multi-site or a single-site church. But really, even a church that may have a formal liturgy doesn't mean that when its pastors get together, you know, they're more likely to follow Robert's Rules of Order or any other kind of formality in their gatherings. This is an era in the United States, at least, of great informality or increasing informality across all traditions.
Well, that's really interesting to think. You mentioned something about life stage of a church. Tell us a little bit about that. That's an interesting phrase.
Well, one of the churches we visited was 3 years old, and we met over dinner, which was a lot of fun, but in part because they don't have a building. This is our office. You know, that's Starbucks and other places, and it was one paid pastor and two volunteers who kind of, the expression is tent making, like the Apostle Paul, who, you know, did a day job in order to support the ministry, and so that was one context of life where they don't have long entrenched traditions. They're very much finding their way forward. They don't know, and anyone involved in their church, of course, has been involved 3 years or less as well. So all aspects of leadership development are all in the new formation stage versus, well, I'd say, I'm trying to think of a really old church we visited, all right, in Oklahoma, where, all right, they had roughly 75 years. So they've got traditions for most everything. And you know, that's a different kind of animal to lead.
I can imagine that the older churches tend to be a little bit more formal in their teams because they've been doing it for decade after decade, and it's just easier to keep the same old wheel going.
Maybe not the word formal so much as routine.
Routine, okay.
You know, well, this is, you know, our staff has always gathered on Tuesday mornings, or, you know, this is the room we always use, or it's kind of traditional that we start with worship and have a little devotional and do this or that, which any other size church may do. It's just these churches have done this for quite a while. So for the pastor or anyone else to wake up in the morning and say, I've got an idea, you know, let's do it this way, just takes a little more navigation and dealing with a little more resistance or just needing to create dissatisfaction with the status quo to justify, you know, hey, maybe it is okay if we try this in a different way.
One of the things that your book does is divide teams into teams that succeed and teams that fail. My question here is, how do you know you're looking at failure and how do you know you're looking at success?
There was no clear dividing line that, you know, okay, well, if they didn't do over, you know, certain percentage on this question, then they are failing. Yeah, I see how you could see words like, okay, our title is Teams That Thrive, and our kind of research methodology was to take the top performing teams, but not to conclude, I think it'd be misleading to conclude that those are the only ones that are working and everybody else is failing. It's all a matter of degrees.
Mm-hmm.
These tend to be work, and frankly, Tony, that's the most difficult pitch of our book. We started off writing to those who were really floundering, and we decided that typically those are not as interested or calling for help or as much that our book can help so much as the teams that are doing okay and are perhaps a little satisfied with, oh, you know, I never occurred to me our team could get better. For us to give pictures to them and say, well, you know, this is what it might look like to fire on all cylinders, and for a church to say, wow, if that's what a team can do, you know, hey, let's get better at this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's those that are doing okay that are the greatest receptors of the book, and who we really wrote to, who want to get better, than those who are so discouraged that they've all but given up.
So let's do that. Let's take a look at the churches that are succeeding, that are firing on all cylinders, and you seem to see some patterns on things that they do here. What are some of those keys to successful team leadership that you discovered?
Well, that's what we put in the subtitle, The Five Disciplines of Collaborative Church Leadership. And basically, after we had spent a couple of weeks playing with correlations of all kinds in our crunching of the data, we said, well, you know what? Could we identify five common themes that seem to be characteristic of churches that are, in our words, thriving? And the first is that you have purpose, as we call it, the invisible leader of your team, that there's really an alignment of purpose and a clarity of purpose. And in fact, we came up with five C's to alliterate, to deal with the compellingness of your purpose, that becomes kind of the navigator of your team even more than your leader. And that's an alignment with your church vision, but also an alignment with the uniqueness of your purpose as a team and how much that affects how you shape your meeting. I mean, we've all been to businesses or churches that have a nice mission statement on the wall, and you walk away thinking, does anybody ever talk about that? You know, does it really impact what they're doing? Because there's sure a gap. And we wanted just the opposite. Churches that were, we found that the more churches engage in their purpose and as a team and as a church, the more likely they are to be effective, thriving teams.
And I can imagine that's very important, too, because it doesn't rely on one particular personality. And, you know, personalities, you know, leave the church after a while. People come and go, and sometimes you just don't show up. So having that invisible team leader, that invisible or that purpose that leads the team is pretty crucial there.
Another one would be this idea of the leadership comes more by inspiration than just control to lead. You know, again, 50 years ago, hierarchy across most churches was strong enough that, well, it's the pastor's idea. The pastor thinks this is what we ought to do. You know, the matter is settled. And or, you know, we're doing this because the pastor says so. and the pastor is saying so because he says that's how the Bible says so. If it's relevant to that particular aspect of leading. And now much more there is a factors of passion and heart and buy-in and that, you know, this is what we need to be doing, that there's an excitement about that rallies people intrinsically to be motivated, far more than because structurally they have to.
Now, is that something that is hard to capture in a bottle? Do you need a unique personality in order to do that? Or is that something that a church can really reproduce over time? Because I can imagine you get a young pastor and they're very inspirational and they're great, but over time, you know, pastors get tired or pastors fall into ruts. And so is this something that a church can foster in the long run?
It is. And we find that in sharing the leadership at different levels, in the group owning the decision as opposed to just, you know, hey, we're going to give our advice and then the top person makes the decision and we've done our job. We're deciding this together and we're going to own the implementation, it tends to draw out inspiration rather than control through structure or hierarchy.
I can see how that actually plays into one of the other disciplines, too, that lead to successful, thriving teams, and that's leveraging the difference in different team members.
Right, and this is where it's not the top three people who all think alike and who all were trained in the same way. And actually, we caution against taking your organizational chart and just drawing a circle around the top positions and saying, there, we've got our senior leadership team. But really saying, you know, if we all think alike, then we really don't need to be a team. We need, in healthy ways, to have a diversity of perspectives, of talent, of life stage, where theologically appropriate, of gender, of many other things, factors.
Yeah, and that must be built into the mission purpose as well, to make sure that you're constantly looking for somebody who has different skills or comes from a different viewpoint, right?
Right. And, well, again, way back when, the pastor was called the parson, and the word parson comes from person, and much like we shout to a athletic figure, you know, you're the man, you're the woman. The pastor was the most educated, the most skilled, the most everything in the community. Today, in a community with some degree of education to it, in a church community, you're going to have, you know, this person has a rich background in grant writing, and this person has huge training in HR, human resource management, and this person has tremendous background in the arts and drawing from that diversity of perspectives, all of which just enrich what a senior leadership team can do and how it approaches and even identifies challenges.
One of the other five disciplines that churches that thrive tend to have in common as well is that they have intentionally structured their decision-making process. Explain what that means.
Well, again, this is different from the business world. There's a prayer piece. There's a following the promptings of the Holy Spirit piece, as well as there is the rigors of logic and evidence and facts and all. And so not only do you have the, you know, how do we collaborate both with the Holy Spirit and with the data we have on hand, so to speak, but then there's the how do we go about making decisions, and we encourage, and actually, Tony, there's probably nothing in the book that people are going to go, oh, that is something no one in the world has ever said. It's not the content so much as how you put it together. How do we make sure that we make a decision that we're not just deferring to the senior member or the oldest member or the longest term member? How do we make decisions that it's truly a process of that brings out the best in everyone and brings out the best results for the church?
And I can imagine that's something that has to be modeled over time, too. It's not just something that's written on paper and bylaws, but you have to live that out as well.
And in fact, that's the fifth discipline of the Teams That Thrive, the culture of continuous collaboration. And that is not just continually working together, but continually getting better as a team. It's not like, okay, we read this book, and, you know, we did it over the next two week period, and now we're a team that thrives, and now we'll go forward, we'll give the book away to someone else and continue being a team that thrives. No, it's a continual collaborative effort to grow, to learn, to get better, to refine, to self-reflect.
Mm-hmm. And I can, the one thing that I read too in that the process of continuous collaboration is that the collaboration as a process becomes very important, and that individuals can plug in at various points in time. And that relates to one of the books that you recently wrote as well about pastor succession, is that, you know, teams are going to change in their nature over time, but it's that collaborative process that is continually modeled that becomes very, very important. So we have these five different disciplines that work very effectively that get these church teams firing on all cylinders. Do you have any examples of a church where all of this stuff is coming together?
Sure. Let me just name one. Faith Promise Church, Knoxville, Tennessee. It's a larger church, several thousand people. And they were working on a WIG, W-I-G, which is Wildly Important Goal, that would frame the staff's initiative and establish their accountability for the coming year. And you would think, okay, this is a big deal. This is a big decision. And on top of that, they were working on adding another campus. Again, larger churches tend to be multi-site, and having to make some decisions about that. And what was fascinating and beautiful was to see they are not in lockstep. They were, I don't know if argued is too strong a word, but they really, you know, went, they were brutally honest with each other. Let's say it that way. And they challenged each other. But they ultimately decided as a team how to move forward, and because they had the trust framework, the rapport with each other, the appreciation of each other, they could do this in a relatively quick amount of time. For the level of decision they made, Ryan was Hartwick, the lead author, was on site for that to watch and see how it came together so quickly is like, wow, this team really knows how to connect and work with each other.
That's a really interesting finding, because we think that teams that are always successful always get along all the time. But you just hinted at the fact that sometimes they're going to disagree.
Well,
and
if they don't disagree, we found that they're not as healthy. That you need that distance. Now, how to disagree in what churches would describe as a Christ-like, you know, God-honoring way, there's an art to that. You know, there are boundaries. We don't hit below the belt, so to speak, in terms of harsh words or mean or personal criticism. But there's all kinds of ways to play, again, to use another church term, the devil's advocate in a way that brings out the best decision. Now, what's going to be the pushback to this? What's going to be the concern? Are we really speaking for the whole congregation? What about those that we're trying to reach? What about, you know, and for people to say, no, I think we're pushing this too fast. I think we're trying to do this. It's beautiful to see when that's a real dialogue. But it's got some sparks that come along if it's true that you've got a nice diversity on your team, and that there is a trusting atmosphere where honesty is welcome and it's safe to voice.
I want to close out here with a couple questions that take you a little bit outside your book, but also put you inside of your own organization, the leadership network that you're working with, as well as thinking about some of the broader trends in society. Let's first start with the leadership network. You're with this organization. You've been writing a number of books and connecting with a lot of different folks. What does the leadership network do? Is this one of these places where churches can learn about how to better manage themselves, and how do they get connected with you?
Let me tell you the story of how we got started. A guy named Bob Buford, who wrote a book called, a subtitle, From Success to Significance, it's called Halftime with the Book, realized that he had made a lot of money, so he'd been successful, but he'd never really done anything significant for God, besides pass out bulletins at church or the like. So he thought, well, what if I used my business skills to help this emerging group of churches to know how to go forward? And his mentor had been Peter Drucker, yes, the Peter Drucker, business guru, and so he got Peter Drucker's coaching on what to do, and by and large worked with Christianity Today and got all the, at the time, this is 31 years ago, largest attendance churches, the senior pastors and their spouses, together for several days. And he had all this content that he thought that they would want to know as they were all trying to kind of push size barriers that no one had pushed before. Well, when they got together, they just started chatting with each other. Oh, I wanted to meet you. I heard you had this neat prayer ministry. Tell me about it. I heard you're doing this thing with young adults. How are you reaching them? Tell us about it. And at the end of the days together, they all said, oh, Mr. Drucker, this is the best thing possible. You must do this again. And so he calls Peter Drucker and he says, what happened? I didn't get to any of my content. And Drucker said, you got entrepreneurs together and you gave them a level playing field and you gave them permission to learn from each other. And that's what Leadership Network has done ever since. We figure out who is finding some kind of innovation. I've mentioned multi-site. We got together, the early pioneers, just over 10 years ago. People who all thought they were reinventing the wheel, and we got them together in the same room and said, you're all doing the same thing. The word multi-site didn't even exist. You know, let us help you talk to each other and share your best practices, your leading practices. And then some of those turn into books, which is what I get to do. But that's what we do. And to track with us or connect with us, find out specific ways to be involved, just go to leadnet.org/advance. That's the newsletter email that I oversee that talks about different things, many of them free, like we do many times a year a free online video conference. Our next one up is on churches who have all contributed 5-minute videos on ways they've tried to stimulate generosity in their congregations, or any number of other topics that are free, and then we have peer gatherings, and those are fee-based, and all kinds of other ways that we try to serve pioneering churches.
Let me close out with a final question about how Leadership Network has been working with the general religious landscape, and this is a wraparound question that takes us back to our initial discussion about what's happening in the United States in terms of religiosity. Things are changing, and we can't deny that, and I think churches that ignore the fact that there are demographic and cultural changes that are occurring might not be able to survive long into the future. So in terms of what you've seen over the course of your studies, how has church leadership been able to adapt to the different changes? And are you fairly optimistic that churches today, in large, are doing a pretty good job of figuring out how to manage these changing circumstances?
Well, that's quite a question, and anybody that can answer it well, could have a book, a show, or anything else. So I will attempt something. First of all, I'm going to speak as an insider in that I'm part of that faith group, and I believe there's a God who says I will build my church, and that no matter how much messing up or ineptitude we humans do, that the God we serve is greater and more able to do anything than we could try to do. So that's where my ultimate hope is. And yet, we have the privilege of collaborating with our wonderful God, and of who is the creator of the universe, and who in many places encourages us to imagine and shape and create, and to take the core teachings of Scripture, the Gospel, and to frame them in a way that people can best hear, can best respond to, and applies best to their world. So overall, I am optimistic. There are challenges and challenges of remaining fixed, of not remaining true to the core message of Scripture. We're in a culture today where, once upon a time, American culture and Christian values were seen to be very aligned, and today, in many ways, or at least from some people's point of view, the cultural values, even the laws of the land, are no longer supportive, and in some places antithetical to Christian belief, and that's going to draw out a new character of the Christian church. Finally, going back to the Pew study, part of my take on the Pew study is that the millennial generation is in general not big on committing to anything. So not committing to religion is just one part of that generational characteristic. And we have to figure out yet again, how do we connect with this next generation in a way that's true to the message and theology, but gives up some of our sacred cows that are not required by our faith and may no longer be working even as much as we still enjoy them.
Well, I think that is something that we'll have to keep looking forward to as we move throughout the future here and see how churches do adjust to that. And I know that you will be watching very closely on how these changes are affecting church leadership and how church leadership in turn affects these changes.
Tony, you will too. You underplay yourself, but you are quite the scholar, researcher, contributor as well.
Well, I thank you for that, and that's one of the things we try to do here on Research on Religion is to look at all these themes and pull together a lot of people from different parts of the world who can see these different trends and help us kind of understand them a little bit more. So I want to thank you for plugging me, and I also want to thank you for being on our show today. My guest today has been Warren Bird. Thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My privilege and joy. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.